Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
It's the Drink Talking with the Thinking Drinkers, Ben McFarland and Tom Sandon, and Mistress of Wine, Sam Capon. All the booze news and views, from Absinthe to Zinfandel. The Drinks Cabinet is now sitting.
Hello and welcome again to our podcast. It's The Drink Talking, a podcast all about alcohol, and we will be pouring more drinks information into your ears over the next half an hour or so. My name's Tom Sandham, and I am joined by the co-presenters, who are Sam Capon. Hello, Sam.
Hi, Tom.
How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Have you recovered from your hangover? You had a hangover on one of our podcasts.
Yeah, no, I feel tip-top.
That's brilliant. That's a miraculous and speedy recovery. Well done.
Thank you.
Sam, anything you'd like to say?
No.
Okay. And Ben McFarland, who's a beer expert, and my peer, my business partner, my life partner, the other
and
thinking
friend.
Drinker and friend. Thinking drinker. How are you, Ben?
I'm very well, thanks, Tom.
Looking forward to getting out there with our show to places like Harlow and Epsom and Millham.
Epsom, Millham, Barnard Castle, Luton, Southend.
Luton sold out, ladies
Luton
and gentlemen.
Luton is sold out. Luton. Reading,
boom.
Swindon.
Yeah.
Hull?
Not Hull. No.
Do you know anyone in Hull?
No.
The Spree Festival in Paisley, yeah. Mm. Pretty good. So off the back of Edinburgh, we're doing our tour, going around the country in our Royal Mail van. We have the Thinking Drinkers mobile is an ex-Royal Mail van.
Mm. I didn't know you had your own mobile.
We do, man.
Is there a picture of you dudes on the side?
Not yet.
Is it on your incognito? So you don't
it's
pretty hard to miss, I'll live with you. Just the noise alone.
A lot of people haven't missed it by the looks of the dents on the side of it.
I think you need to tweet a photo of that. I need to see it.
Okay.
But the best thing about it is that when we bought it, we were driving back up the M6 or something like that, and I pulled the sun visor down, and this big gold key fell out of the visor.
Oh, I thought I'd say spider.
No, not spider. And it's a key to all the post boxes.
skeleton key.
Yeah.
Which is treason. You're not allowed to open them.
Well, I was going to say, I imagine you sent it straight back.
No, we've still got it.
It's still in there somewhere.
But I put it into the post box.
To check?
Turned it, but I didn't open it because that is treason.
Is it really treason? Because it's Royal Mail?
Yeah.
The best thing about our van is that when we were driving to Edinburgh one year, we were on the M1, it broke down in the middle lane. It just stopped.
No.
That was bad because we were driving up to Edinburgh and we had about £20,000 worth of booze in the van, and we had to watch as juggernauts just plough past it. And someone was saying the statistics of a broken down vehicle in the middle lane, how long it can survive, is quite a small amount of time. And it was there for a good hour.
Yeah. Oh,
we just
my
had
God,
to watch
that's
it
so
before,
dangerous.
Before they could drag it away.
Yeah. And because we stopped and we didn't get out of the van, we just rang the AA from the van and they said, "Where are you?" And we were like, "The middle lane of the M1. And the woman very calmly just went, "Get out of the van. Get out of the van right now.
Is this not the safest place to be?
Please, get out of the van right now."
So how fast were the cars going past your car?
As fast as you can go on a motorway. Really? Some people were reading books.
People were feeding their dogs in the back seat.
You watch them, you think, you are not in control of this. It's not just people using phones.
So
back then
selfish.
It wasn't even illegal. Yeah. You could use a phone. But people were reading, like, have like full-blown maps.
Yeah.
While driving.
Oh my God. As ever, drink gets the hard knocks. Drinking is barely the worst thing you can do whilst driving. No, it is. You shouldn't drink or drive.
And you shouldn't drive into drink either.
No.
Which was what we were saying. Please don't drive into our drink. Yeah. But we survived, and that van is still going strong and will be taking us to all of our venues, the dates of which are all on our website, thinkingdrinkers.com.
Nice one, Tom. Yeah. Well hosted.
So welcome to our podcast, and we're going to be talking about all things drink, and we're going to start off with some things that have made us pleased or angry about drink over the last week. And it's my turn to talk about spit or swallow. And my spit, folks, is student drinking. Because
students.
That's fairly standard behaviour. Yep.
The two words kind of go hand in hand.
If you go to university, you would expect to at some point be enjoying some alcoholic beverages.
Unless you're one of the people, one out of every four 18 to 24-year-olds who do not drink at
all.
That's
a fair comment. Unless
amazing
you have
stat.
You cannot drink unless you choose not to drink. Mm. But an organisation has recently put out a piece of research. They're called magnet.me. I don't know what me is after a dot. It's not com or co.uk, is it? But anyway, they put out this research and they said 24% of students who they spoke to, and this was 9,000 students, that's a lot, 24% who drink over 20 units in the week have no idea what they want to do as a career. This was on Sky News. They carried the story, and it was a big negative thing. Of these 9,000 drink over 20 units.
Why are the two related?
Well, two things. 24% drink over 20 units. Now, okay, one in four 18 to 24-year-olds are not drinking. I call bullshit on that for a start.
24% of them are lying. Yeah. No, the other
76.
Yeah, so 24% of them are claiming to only drink 20 units. Now, that's seen as the excess. And so those people who drink excessively say they don't know what they want to do as a career. So the second part of this is, if I'm asked when I'm 19 or 20 what I want to be in the future, I'm still saying professional footballer. Yeah. I still think I've got a shot at that.
Even at 20 units a week.
Yeah. I mean, I did an American studies degree.
You didn't know what you were doing.
I did it to avoid that question for 3 years. Yeah. You don't really...
No, I didn't go into uni having a single idea what I was going to do.
What did you do? What was your...
I did English degree.
Right.
And actually, it was at university that myself and two girlfriends ran the Manchester University Wine Society, which is arguably where my first foray...
Well, there we go. But that was the foundations of your career.
Yeah, so it kind of started at 16, 17, and then uni ran the Wine Society, but basically it was... Oh, it's a big piss up, basically.
Yeah.
We had cases and cases of wine in the hall.
Brilliant.
Very popular. People came over a lot.
I can imagine.
Fancy that. However... That's what got me into
your career.
So you would have been the exception in this.
Because so the time I left uni, I did have an idea.
Yeah.
And I went straight
drank,
into it.
Because
yeah,
you drank.
Exactly. So,
units. Ben, did you drink 20 units a week?
I did.
Wow.
But I remember my ex-girlfriend's stepdad genuinely asking me at the age of, I must have been 19 or 20, what I wanted to do. Mm. And I said, I don't know.
Mm.
And he was astonished.
But I just think,
well,
why would you know that?
But also, I could say anything. I'm going to be I'm going to be a lawyer.
Yeah,
I'm going to be an astronaut. I'm going to be a solicitor.
But I think so. Until you enter the job market, you don't know what's out there.
Yeah,
like, you know, when you meet random people who do really crazy jobs, and you think, God, I wouldn't even think that existed.
You know, numbers of people applying for university have fallen off a cliff because people are actually questioning whether they need to get into work and find out what they want to do. Because you've got to sit in that office and be answering telephones and surrounded by Sharon and Dave, who are complete bell ends, and work out, I don't want to be in an office.
Yeah.
I don't want to be here. You need to actually be in that environment to work out. You don't work that out in university anyway. You're meant to sort of develop those sort of social skills. But just to bring back some stats on this, 58% of those 9,000 said they drink once a week, no more than 7 units.
Lying bastards.
I'm also going to call bullshit on that.
Well, I'll tell you what they're going to be when they grow up. Liars.
Yeah. Lawyers. There you go. They are. Okay. Do you know what? 76% of these were very optimistic about securing a job in law or politics. He did say that bit. But, I mean, Ben Thompson, 21, who's a student of the University of the West of England.
Well, it's not university, is it? Is it?
Come on, Ben.
Really?
Well, you pull your socks up. I was at Wolverhampton, and I'm sheepish about that. At least that's a town. West of England.
What's he doing? Pottery mechanics?
Which one? University of West of England. Was it Bristol? No, just the whole of the west of England. I think we're all the same. When we're hungover, we're more likely not to go to uni and miss our lectures.
Yeah. Well,
but also, I think that's part of the culture. You had to go. I mean, I remember sitting at the back of a lecture, you know, being sick in my mouth and swallowing it because you have to go. I mean, that's and now, yeah, more than ever, you're paying 40 grand for your education and you'll go, oh, I was hungover, I didn't go, I didn't bother. And you're giving drink a bad name, yeah, really.
Well, one of the best things I did, and I still look back at it and cringe a little, was on the first day I got to uni, I met a guy who I'd already met before in France who was living and studying there. He was a lot older than me, a guy called Alberto, he was probably 10, 12 years old, and we went to the pub, got quite pissed, and he said to me, he said, so who's your tutor? And I was going, I was just Dutch fella. He's really esteemed in intellectual history, you know. Yeah. And he said, do you know what? There's going to be loads of people on your course. What I did, and it really stood me in good stead, was go to his office and introduce yourself and say I'm actually looking forward to the course. Oh, and I was like, yeah, that sounds sounds pretty good. He goes, no, let's do it. Let's go and see him now. I was like, no, I've had about 8 pints. He's like, no, it'll be fine, it'll be fine. And he took me along there and I knocked on the door, went in there. I must have been annihilated, and this big Dutch guy, I'm really well known in his field, and I introduced myself. Oh, I really look forward to doing it. Yeah, those 4 hours a week. And then shook his hand and did all that. Came out and Alberto went, I can't believe you did that. I've never did that. Boy, you idiot. He never done that at all. But I actually had
any
really
fallout from that, or did
no?
We, did
I think he was. I think he at least remembered me.
Yeah.
And no, he was a real inspiration. Now he's really got a nice guy. Yeah. And over years, I don't think that did me any harm. I think he probably thought this guy's open to creative thought.
And none of it does you any harm because it's 3 years out of your life. You're going to change your mind a lot.
Yeah.
When you're 21, you don't really know a great
deal. Also, you're going to meet people there who go on and do really good stuff, and you can hang on to their coattails.
Yeah.
Or,
I mean,
ring them up when you need a job.
You can end up sat in a room with the person who did intellectual history.
Yeah.
Someone who did American studies, decided to set up a business together.
Yeah. It doesn't matter what you do at university.
You're still going to lose.
Yeah.
Suckers. So there you go. That was my spit. And my swallow is a bit more refined because my swallow is France.
Ooh la la. The whole of France.
Bonjour la classe. The whole country.
Ooh la vache.
Mostly what I like about France is specifically relating to drink, because I've just been in France recently. If you listen to a previous podcast about cognac.
I
might have talked about it a lot.
But I went with Hennessy, took me on a trip, and it was a fantastic trip. Having been on luxury trips all around the world, ladies and gentlemen, kind of a big deal.
Bear in mind, we did precede this by talking about us travelling up and down the country in a Royal Mail van.
It's true. But, it kind of undermines
it. I did once get taken on a private jet to Champagne.
Well, I've just been on a private jet.
I was so,
High five, Sam. Ben, any private jets in
Bear? No, I went to the jet car wash the other day.
Get lost. Get out of here.
When you said you went business class.
Yeah, I was the Eurostar, but we went to Paris, had a night in Paris, and then flew by private jet to Cognac.
From Paris.
With Hennessy, who really looked after us, and thank you, Hennessy. But the point I want to make is that I've done lots of incredible trips all around the world, and the closest comparison I can make really is the world of whiskey, because both categories have got similar stigmas. Maybe they're kind of sometimes seen as a bit stuffy and traditional and a lot of heritage. But when I go to Scotland, I never feel the same levels of sophistication and luxury, and the French just seem to raise the bar when it comes to those beautiful, sophisticated experiences. And when you drive around the vineyards and the countryside in France, you see all the rural buildings and everything rustic, but it's got a bit of class about it.
Oh, and also just these famous places. Like, I studied French for a couple of weeks in Sancerre, and you're going through like Burgundy, and you've got that little Pelligny Montrachet and Bone, and
And all the buildings are old.
I think the buildings look good, and my wife and I were talking about this. Shutters.
Yeah, good quality
shutters,
wooden.
Good shutters.
It's heritage, though. It's vintage. All that stuff is real.
Yeah.
It just looks real. And I mean, I know they didn't get bombed as badly as some during the war.
Why is that, Tom?
Well, you know, they wanted to look after their buildings, frankly. And that's why Paris still looks uniformly traditional and beautiful. And those countryside regions do. And they benefited from that process of not getting involved so much.
It had its drawbacks.
Yeah, of course.
Policy.
Yeah, but you know, let's just
move on.
Appreciate the good things that happened, and the buildings are one of them. And but I think it stretches all the way across. I mean, the big houses that the distilleries in the Scotch
big cognac houses,
but no, but just houses. big houses.
Oh, I see.
The Scotch whiskey industry hold, and we've been to Glenrothes House or Drummuir Castle, but they're all quite twee and cozy, and it all doesn't feel particularly classy. With all due respect, it's an experience.
Well, it's a different weather.
And the rest of the world love that. And it's probably because it feels a bit cliched because we've grown up with it. But when you go to France, and we stayed at the Hennessy House, and it was just epic. And the grounds, deers run across them.
No.
People are rowing across the river at the bottom. You just sat there, and there's just something about France that just seems to tick all the boxes at the same time.
But I think the attitude to drink as well is amazing.
Quite responsible and sophisticated.
Yeah, but they just celebrate it in a very sort of everyday way. You see people
in their DNA,
like, having just one glass of wine with their food, and that's it. They're not getting drunk. They're not ladies who lunch. They're not doing all these It is just part of their daily routine. And it's just such a healthy way of doing it. I went on holiday to Armagnac with my wife and children. In the middle of nowhere, it forced us to do absolutely nothing. It was amazing.
Perfect.
And we did go to an Armagnac distillery, which is just down the road. Once you've been to the church with the tractor outside 10 times.
Yeah.
And so we went to the tiny little producer, and he welcomed us in, and he took us around.
Do you speak French?
Yes. My wife does as well,
does she?
Better than me.
Yeah.
And Remy, our oldest, he has a few words. And one of his things is Je m'appelle, but he doesn't realise it means
this is
my name is. He just uses it as a phrase of exclamation. Mm. So, like, as we were going, Je m'appelle, we used to see everything. And so we got taken into these caves, the cave, the cellars, and the guy showed us this lovely old barrel of Armagnac. He took out the bung, and we all leant in and smelt it. And Remy's too small, so I plopped him onto the barrel, and he stuck his nose in and looked at the guy who makes it and just went, "Je m'appelle."
Good laugh.
And
this
strange guy just looked at me, and we didn't say anything. And he went, "Tu t'appelles?" And Remy went, "Je m'appelle," over and over again.
Well, I don't have much French, and I would have said much the same.
Yes.
And I was saying it all through my trip to Hennessy, because it was phenomenal. I bought you a bit of this luxury back, folks. And sorry, listeners, you can't enjoy this, but I was out there to drink the Hennessy Paradis Imperial.
Spat £10
That is, it's very expensive stuff. It costs £2,000 for a bottle of this stuff,
wow.
Which might explain why I enjoyed France as much as I did, because we sat around and we had a Michelin star chef make us dinner in the founder's cellar at Hennessy, and they served us this beautiful meal, and they served us this cognac, and it is phenomenal.
It is amazing.
Cognac. It's so beautiful. I mean, they've
really
taken
smooth and long.
Ah, beautiful, but elegant. They've taken eau de vies that have spent 50 years in cask, and then some of them have been taken from demijohns that are over 120 years old. So this is like, it's like drinking history, and that's what cognac and the French have done so well, is just present that history through a drink. And it's something that, Ben, I know you, as the Thinking Drinkers, and I'm sure you're the same, Sam, that we really cling on to when we're talking to people about drink. You can tell them all about what it tastes like, how it's made, but if you can back it up with some beautiful stories, some great history, things that make people more interested about it, and take it just a bit away from the drink, I think that people hold on to it a bit more and they value it a bit more. And that's what the French
do so well.
Say magnifique.
Say magnifique. Très bon, je m'appelle. Now, just to go back to our previous spit, which is about students, I studied in France, in Grenoble, and the student attitude to alcohol when I was there amongst the French students was completely different. They all drank, but the idea of getting smashed, they weren't snooty about it. They just didn't get it.
Mm.
Alcohol was part of what they did, but it was just
a more civilised way, integral.
It's just part of the culture. It was just around them all the time.
They probably
drink
about as much as we do over the year. In fact, they do. There's more per capita drinking in France is higher than it is here.
I think more slow and steady.
Less
bingy.
Yeah.
Even like you go to like these service stations and there'll be really nice food and people will be having a glass of wine
at a service
station. And, and I know,
because the wine and food is so linked.
And they don't tax their sins.
Yeah.
They don't tax their pleasures like we do
what
here.
We do, yeah.
What do you think of the Hennessy Paradis Imperial?
It is amazing.
I don't normally get that excited about
£2,000 bottles.
But yeah, I mean, the price tag does obviously lend itself to excitement, but it is, it's just, it is an extraordinary
spirit.
You can
smell it, just, you can smell it from quite a long way away.
Like, yeah,
just...
I mean, they served it up, this dinner, in the inner cellar, but they also had this art installation which they put in, which was incredible as well. And just the whole, the way they did everything from private jets.
They got a bit of cash behind them.
They have. Hennessy are a massive company, but there are bigger companies that rest on their laurels and they don't. And they do embrace and everything about it felt French. They really held on to the core of what they were about. And I just, I really love France and... You know, if they can give me a house there, which interesting, they don't cost that much, do they? You can get 10 bed manners for $200,000.
No, I know.
So that's my spit, that's my swallow. So
excellent.
You enjoyed it. You enjoyed your expensive £200 a glass.
That was
cognac.
Amazing. Thank you very much for bringing it back.
Thank them because they said you were.
Thanks, Hennessy.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
And now it's time to move on to our tasting. And today it's you, Sam, so we're tasting wine.
It's me, it's wine. And today I thought we'd have a little sip of Sauvignon. So I've got two Sauvignon Blancs.
I like the way she went Sauvignon, looked at us, we were like, keep going.
I am a huge fan of Sauvignon Blanc. And interestingly, I was talking to a wine expert recently who said that when it comes to Sauvignon Blanc, and I was joking about picking up a £5 bottle of Sauvignon Blanc in a supermarket, he was saying it's probably one of the one grapes where you can afford to go down in the price scale, and it's actually, if you spend too much money on a Sauvignon Blanc, you're not getting a great deal more for your money. Is that fair? Or
The thing I would say with Sauvignon is it's quite aromatic, so it's instantly quite recognisable. So with Sauvignon, largely it doesn't go in oak, or so all the things that make a wine quite expensive, like imagine if you had a Chardonnay and, you know, and they put it in oak barrels and aged it, what have you, all that kind of thing makes wine more expensive. But so with Sauvignon, normally it's quite crisp and it's fresh and it's fermented in stainless steel, so the winemaking process is sort of cheaper. But there are certainly places like in Bordeaux or the New World where they'll do like a wild ferment and they'll age it in oak. Like any wine, there's a huge...
Of course. I think it just meant if I was making a supermarket purchasing choice between the prices of £5 and £20.
Yeah, and Sauvignon maybe... generally is never terrible.
Right.
So I think there is a point there in that it's kind of light and crisp and fresh and, you know, whatnot. In fact, if you go to the pub, the Sauvignon's probably quite a good choice to have because it's just kind of, you kind of know what you're getting.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing with Sauvignon, I think, is they have flavour compounds in Sauvignon called methoxypyrazines or pyrazines. And they've got different ones. You've got IBMP, IPMP, SBMP. BMP, they're all related to different smells. So Sauvignon's got classic aromas, particularly of green things like grass, herbs, nettles, elderflower, bell pepper, sort of capsicum. And the different ones create these different smells. So when people do say, oh, the problem with wine is I taste wine, and to me it just tastes of wine, actually if you practice, it shouldn't do. You know, you've generally got these flavour compounds that really do smell of certain things.
Right.
So here, the first one we're trying, because we're going to compare, we've got a Sancerre, and then we're going to try a New Zealand Sauvignon. So the thing with Old World, New World, Old World's Europe, New World's outside of Europe, and the complication as well in Europe, in the Old World, they label by region.
Right.
So Sancerre is Sauvignon, okay. But yeah, you need a bit of knowledge to know. So yeah. You've got Sancerre, you've got Parfumé, you've got Cancime, Montussalon, Rouy, you've got all these different places that all produce Sauvignon, particularly in the Loire in France, and then you've got sort of Bordeaux and elsewhere.
Have Sancerre recognised that as a stumbling block and started putting Sauvignon Blanc on bottles as well?
I had a Touraine Sauvignon recently, and it did have Sauvignon on the bottle.
Yeah, because that isn't something I knew. I have to say, I'm very ignorant of that.
So it's complicated, because basically you've got all these wine laws that basically lay down what grapes can be grown in what region. Mm. So in Chablis, you can only grow Chardonnay. So all Chablis is Chardonnay. Mm. In Burgundy, legally, they can only, for white, grow Chardonnay in Burgundy and Pinot Noir for red. So from Burgundy, they're the two grapes you get. And the same in the Loire, you only pretty much get Sauvignon in a lot of these places, or Chenin. And a red Sancerre will be Pinot. And then when you go, go to Italy, you need to learn that, you know, Chianti is Sangiovese, and you go to Rioja, and Rioja is Tempranillo predominantly. Mm. And that's kind of, you know, Barolo is Nebbiolo. So for anyone interested in wine, the first thing that's good to learn is what regions grow what grapes, because what the grape is the biggest determining factor of what the wine tastes like. So once you can lock in what the grape is, you can start to build up what the wine should taste like, and then whether you like it.
It sounds restrictive. Is that why New World wines have sort of punched Old World on the nose a bit?
I think New World wines are much easier to understand. You go onto the label and it says on it, Sauvignon, or Chardonnay, or Viognier, or Shiraz, or what have you. So I think it does make it much easier, because a lot of people might say, oh, I hate Chardonnay, but then they love Chablis, and they don't know what grape variety goes into those wines that are labelled by the village name. Like, you know, Sancerre is a place. You go to Sancerre and... So the first one is a Sancerre, but very light colour. And again, as I said before, just really fresh winemaking, made in stainless steel tanks, cool ferment. And it's quite subtly green, so...
Quite minerally.
I'm getting a bit of almond on that. Something quite subtle and... nutty, but also mostly
green,
like
herby,
fresh,
and crisp, fresh, high acid, no oak. So this is very, very refreshing, crisp, light.
Wow,
zingaling.
I like that. Mm. My go-to drinking behaviour over the course of an evening now would start with a very crisp, dry white wine with some Twiglets, maybe peanuts, maybe plain crisps, cheap ones, supermarket brand, dipped into hummus.
I had some lentil crisps in hummus recently. I'm trying to get healthier. Delicious.
That'll do it.
Why are you put on a stone?
A pot of hummus. I ate a whole pot of hummus.
And lentil crisps.
But...
needed a poo. But I'm making the dinner, so then I would move on to...
So this Sancerre, £2,000 bottle of cognac. Thanks, Hennessy. This Sancerre Le Coyote, 2016, is from Sainsbury's.
Oh. How much?
I think it's £13, and I think it's on offer.
See, I've got to say...
I wouldn't spend
£13 on that.
But
not because I don't like it. But yeah, it's
because I can get a Sauvignon Blanc for £6 I enjoy.
That's another thing with the Old World wines from places like Sancerre and so on. You know, it's from a very specific place, and it's like supply and demand. Mm. And these places tend to produce quite expensive wines.
Yeah. I contradict myself, because I much prefer the idea of that to...
Of a Sancerre.
Yeah, because of that heritage.
It's so subtle, it's so nuanced, though, that I wonder whether you're going to be really picking up the value. The real distinguishable difference in taste is harder to ascertain, as opposed to another style of wine where you go, okay, that is very thin and this is much more full-bodied. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, you're basically saying you're going for the same kind of flavour profile, possibly, and it's likely to be sort of fresh and zippy. You're buying Sancerre as a soft brand. Like, it's not like you're going out and buying, I don't know, Jacob's Creek or whatever. You know, Sancerre is
absolutely
a brand as well. So some people will... see themselves as sommelier drinkers rather than Sauvignon drinkers.
It's a nicer thing to bring it's around
quite,
to dinner,
exactly,
isn't it?
It's quite sophisticated, and if you're going to, you know, go and take a bottle of wine to someone's for dinner.
Yeah. But just on New
Think Z- on the job, Ben.
New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, you know that Asda one? This is purely coincidental because I wrote down a label that I saw in Asda.
Right.
And it's New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And this is a bit of a bugbear of mine, is this kind of the sort of tasting notes that are a bit sort of pally and chatty and kind of, hi guys, we're just a bottle of wine and we want to be your mate kind of thing. I'll read it out to you. New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. The name says it all. When we're not bungee jumping, jet boating, rugby playing and shearing sheep, we're down among the vines in Marlborough watching the grapes grow. Then, when the time is right, and the rugby isn't on, we pick them, and some months of winemaking magic later, out pops a world-beating fruity bottle of awesome you're about to pop into your trolley. Cheers to that.
I'd buy the Sancerre.
I'm a Sancerre kind of drinker.
I am a Sancerre drinker.
I mean, that description alone should make you boycott.
Yeah.
Not only is it grammatically wrong, it's just
lame.
It's just lame. Mm. And it's clichéd, and it should be shit.
You're putting them up on their grammar, which is the least of
it's
my
the
problem
least,
with it.
Yeah.
Well, that has got a real aroma of fur on it. It's sort of like a lamb's wool.
Sounds a bit of a gamble to me. Oh, stop it.
So, moving on.
Yeah.
So, this is Brancourt Estate Terroir Series.
Whoa.
Sauvignon
see, quite
from
Marlborough.
I've now got to look at the back label. So it doesn't have quite as distinctive a back label as your Asda bungee jumping one. But interestingly, it does say that blah, blah, blah. The terroir is an intriguing combination of location, soil, climate and a vigneron's touch that provides a unique personality to the wine.
A vigneron's touch.
Who is vigneron? Who is that? What is he touching?
The vigneron, the winemaker, has obviously made his touch felt and it's got a lovely little gold medal winning wine from the New Zealand International Wine Show.
Now, that does that matter? Do you think those things on the label, in a supermarket, they
do?
They
actually, because I'm a judge at a number of competitions. And we,
so you can't undermine them.
So I really can't undermine them.
So that's my paycheck.
And,
pays
guys,
mortgage.
We worked really hard to taste all the wines.
Yeah, yeah.
And then decide which are the best ones we've tasted. And to win a gold medal is not an easy thing to do.
No,
you know, for one of the competitions I taste for, you've got to score 95 plus points out of 100 to get a gold.
That's quite,
so, you know, it's got to be a bloody good wine. And this is really, I do think this is a really lovely New Zealand Sauvignon.
It
it's got
good.
Quite different to the Sancerre. It's a lot more exuberant. It's more fruity. It's got
it's
a
got
very distinct style. They do sometimes bottle Sauvignon with a tiny bit of CO2 to keep it very fresh.
Mm. And what I like about it is if I can't be bothered to go to and from the fridge and I have no chilling vessel.
Yeah.
Actually, it's not that cold at the moment.
But this is room temperature.
Lots of flavours start to come out as it gets warmer.
Yeah. So that's a really interesting point, actually, because I didn't chill these, and the reason I didn't chill them was A, can't be bothered, and two.
Yeah, that's good.
And two, I think sometimes wines are drunk too cold. You know, in the summer, if it's hot, you know, you want something that's refreshing, sort of temperature wise. But the problem with really chilling a wine is it hampers the aromas. It totally flattens the aromas.
Yeah.
And I remember tasting wine and quite enjoying it. By the end of the meal, I loved it. And it wasn't because I'd drunk in a couple of glasses. It's because actually it opened up and it was just sort of softer. And so these wines have not been chilled. And consequently, the aromas are really pinging out. Going back to the pyrazine thing, some classic aromas in New Zealand Sauvignon particularly are sort of passion fruit and asparagus. And that is one of those three flavour compounds, the pyrazines. I think it's the I can't remember they're called now.
IPDD.
You know, it was the
IPBB.
No.
IPP. Does it make your PP smell? Because it's got
asparagus. No, it should do. But it's the asparagus. It's one of those specific pyrazine flavour compounds.
There we go.
Yeah.
I like that.
But they're good, aren't they? Very distinctive.
Really,
really
nicely with my Watsits fresh. And Twiglets. And
yeah, the thing with Sauvignon is it goes very well with some dishes that are hard to match. Asparagus, tomatoes...
Ah.
Are very hard to match with.
Because when I'm making, you know, when I'm exploring my cuisine and I'm making salad,
I'll
occasionally eat some of the salad while I'm chopping it.
Salad, very good with...
But what's ultimately frustrating for me is that if I drink that New Zealand wine, I go, I like Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm.
I really like it. And then I speak to you and go, which area of France does Sauvignon Blanc? You go, oh, Sancerre. And I go, oh, I'm going to go buy a Sancerre. And then I drink that. It's totally different.
I know.
It's totally different.
I know.
So whilst the grape does dictate a lot, it doesn't at the same time. Mm. They're two very different wines. I'm sure there is a wine made in France in a completely different region using a completely different grape that tastes more like a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc than a Sancerre does.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting point. So basically, the grape is definitely the first part to understand in terms of wine education. Like, lock in the grape, lock in what those flavours are. And then the next tier is regional distinction. So learning that South African Sauvignon, for example, is really green peppery, and New Zealand is more asparagus, gooseberry, passion fruit, and France is more sort of gunflint, mineral, elderflower. But they all have very strong family connections. So they are all green, pyrazine-y, fresh, high acid, generally not oaked. So if you don't like oak, you don't like wines that have gone through like malolactic fermentation, are really kind of creamy and smooth, and you like that kind of refreshment, they are quite clearly part of the same family.
Right.
But interestingly, I would say Sauvignon is arguably the grape that has the most regional distinctions, that is the most different according to where it's grown in the world. But then Chardonnay has loads as well.
Wow. I want to hear more about this judging on other wines, because you should bring in wines that you've judged, Sam. So we can,
I think
95, you give
anything
95
that's got,
gold. Yeah, you should do that.
What are like the Oscars of the wine world? There's going to be badges on bottles from different competitions all over the world. Is there like a Medaille d'Or?
There's loads all around the world. You get the
which one pays you the most to be there?
The International Wine Challenge.
Yes.
Oh, they are good.
Yeah. So we love those guys as much as Hennessy.
Yeah. I'm a panel chair for them, so I run a team and we do the judging.
Ah, okay. So
and do you get paid for that?
Yeah.
Good.
Do all the judges get paid for
it? I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
The idea that people wouldn't. And there are some people out there who think you'd just give the time up because you enjoy
seriously?
It.
Seriously?
It's hard work.
When you get an email going, hi, can you come to Portugal and judge for 4 days a competition, we'll pay you your flight and hotel.
Well, and I can go on holiday to Portugal anytime I want.
Yeah. But,
and I don't have
you
to hang out with you guys. True,
with.
And I've got two small children who chain me to my home. Except when I go on luxury tours. Anyway, that's the tasting,
Sam.
Thank you. I particularly enjoyed it because I am a Sancerre drinker. I was a Sauvignon Blanc drinker. We haven't really had much about beer, have we, in this podcast?
No, so but it's about to change,
Tom.
Let's have a legend of liquor who's hopefully beer-related, Ben.
He's a wonderful man, and not many people know about him. In fact, very few people beyond the kind of impassioned beer connoisseur will know this guy. In a way, his legacy is the great beer that you are drinking in pubs and bars at the moment, and the reason why, when we go into a supermarket, there's such a depth and breadth of flavour and style, is in some ways inspired by this guy who is not championed enough, in my opinion. And this man is called Jack McAuliffe. And he is the godfather, rather reluctant godfather, of the American craft brewing scene. Now, most people attribute...
Is he American?
He is American. Mm-hmm.
Still alive?
He's still alive, but he's quite reclusive.
He's not really big...
No, he doesn't brew anymore.
He's not a face in the industry in
really
any way,
isn't,
is he?
He isn't, and many people have tried to give him the credit that he's due. But most people associate the West Coast brewing scene with... the godfathers, people like Ken Grossman, who's still running Sierra Nevada,
and
Fritz Maytag, who
made washing machines.
He made washing machines first, as families and washing machine magnate. And he then breathed life back into Anchor Brewing, which their Anchorstein beer being their flagship beer. But the real man that inspired them all and really gave them the faith to get into brewing was this man called Jack McAuliffe. And now, he was an American guy who joined the Navy. He spent the mid-1960s in Scotland in a place called Holyrock. He used to repair the Navy's first nuclear submarines.
Flipping heck.
And near the lock was a small town of Dunoon, where all the sailors, freshman shifts, would go and drink loads of different beers. Coming from America, hadn't experienced this wee heavy and bitter and best bitter, things like that. And so they had beers from all over the UK. And then when he went back to America, went back to the West Coast, all he could drink was sort of lackluster, boring lagers. And so illegally, he started homebrewing, because homebrewing was still illegal because of Prohibition. Then he set up his own brewery on the back of this called New Albion, named after the explorer Francis Drake called the Pacific Northwest New Albion. So he named it after that. Jack McAuliffe was an engineer and he was brilliant at welding. And so he bought these old Pepsi, Coca-Cola tanks and welded them together. I mean, it was like something out of the A-Team. He basically put things together. It's really rudimentary brewery that was way ahead of its time. There was no one else doing this. And the idea back then, even though sort of people were becoming sick of the big corporate America and were starting to, in terms of food and restaurants, were starting to do things a bit more artisan, and the wine revolution was sort of kicking in there, but no one was talking about beer and everyone thought he was mental. He started brewing these British beer styles on this rudimentary brewery, and it was successful for a bit. But because there was no one else there, there was no support, there was no network, there's no one to bounce ideas off, he actually went bust quite quickly. Oh. He started in 1976, and then I think in 1982, he shuttered the whole operation. But in that time, there were other people homebrewing, people like Ken Grossman and Fritz Maytag. He inspired them to realise that you can be totally skint, but still set up a brewery. But in 2007, we were at the Craft Beer Brewing Conference in San Diego, and he was awarded a lifetime achievement, Jack. But he didn't turn up. He sent a guy called Don Barkley to go down there, who was his sort of protege at the time, his sort of
right-hand man
who set up the Mendocino Brewery, who himself is seen as a bit of a hero as well, to accept the award. I mean, he's a real recluse. But they brewed a beer together, another New Albion beer, and all the profits of the sale of this beer with Jim Cook and Ken Grossman were given to Jack. And Jack gave it to his daughter, who he hadn't seen for years and years, who he adopted. And she's now brewing that in Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, cool.
So he's someone that really stays out of the limelight. And he's only operating for 6 years, but his legacy and what he did...
It was like the godfather of...
Yeah, I mean, he really went out on a limb and didn't succeed and has made very, very little money from it.
And does he make beer now?
No. He sort of says he's more than happy to advise people, but he certainly doesn't like the limelight.
I think you talk about the way he put his kit together, even that, you know, and what craft means, that legacy of... We were down in places like Alesmith and they were using old dairy kit, people scrapping together any materials they could. I mean, that's been inspired by him. He started off like that and showed people what can be achieved with nothing. You don't have to buy expensive kit here.
And the other thing he did, which was really, really important, along with Fritz Maytag, was that they lobbied Californian authorities, the sort of legislature, to allow you to brew and sell beer on the same premises, i.e. a brew pub.
Yeah.
He went bankrupt in 82 and it passed in 83, and if he just held on, that would have stayed. But the legacy of that is that the brew pub thing is massive in California.
Yeah.
He's just done so much, and the reason that people like Ken Grossman and Fritz and anyone, and Ballast Point down in San Diego just sold up to one of the big guys, who they're probably messing about on super yachts and are very, very rich. They've made a lot of money out of a scene that he started, and I'm not saying they should give any money to him.
I think
there's a lot of goodwill.
And a bit of luck. Sometimes you're in the right place at the right time. Like all these, I don't know, social media tech entrepreneurs who've been the first person to do something well. There might have been loads of people before.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope my legacy, or our legacy rather, is that we come out of this penniless, that we've inspired other people to make similar drinks podcasts and they thrive commercially. That will give me a lot of pleasure.
That's what we're aiming at here.
But I think there is a lot of goodwill within the craft brewing fraternity that everyone's been like, come on, you've really kick-started this and we owe you a debt.
It's good to go back, and
we never tasted the beer because it tastes like shit. But at least he was trying. Yeah, if it's anything based on Scottish beer from the 60s, then Christ knows what it tastes like. But at least it was different and he was doing something. So I think we should all raise a glass to Jack McAuliffe.
Good one.
Well, that probably brings us to the end.
I think it does indeed.
Fantastic podcast. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it.
Have we got some questions? questions to answer.
We have. It turns out that people are enjoying our podcast and that they are contacting us
frequently
via the medium of emails internationally. Now, we've had an email in
from South Africa,
listeners. So, you know, feel free to email to us as well. And
when we can answer these questions. It came from a guy in South Africa, and I must apologise. I haven't got his name here, but he wanted to know. He was very fascinated about, I'll talk about Diplomatico rum.
Yeah, good rum.
My favourite.
Because we were talking about how to drink it, and it's best drunk neat. And he's talking about how with whiskey, a lot of people say you should have it with a bit of water to open up the aromas, make it easier to drink. Could you or should you do the same with a rum such as Diplomatico?
With any high-strength spirit, adding a bit of water will have the same effect. So, yes, it will. The chemical compounds, it will open it up so that you can get some of those aromas. While we talk a lot about not chilling things down, I don't think it matters to have a piece of ice in a rum like that, particularly as
I like a bit of ice.
I associate rum with a sort of
a warm
moment as well. So you just if you're in the heat, whereas with whiskey, you probably associate it more with the fire and the coziness. Mm. So I don't know if it's that much of a problem to put a piece of ice in it as well. A bit of water lengthens it and makes it last a bit longer, and it's strong. So yes, you can do with it what you like, mate.
Okay, well, that's not the only correspondence we've had. We've also had a text message in.
That's a bit sinister.
From a man called Jack Simpson. And his question, well, it's less of a question, more of just something he's done. Mm. So I don't know how to react to this, how you want, Sam. It's about wine. He said that when he was in Australia, he had a wine made using grapes that had been affected by a bushfire.
Yeah.
And he said it was smoky.
Yes, it wouldn't. I don't think they'd have gone and sourced the grapes specifically to create a wine that smelt of bushfire. I suspect it's kind of like sometimes you'll have fires and that can imbue the wine with some smoky, like a taint. I would perceive that as a fault.
Okay, try and get rid of it.
But it's also interesting because it makes you think, the grapes have roots that are coming up from the soil, but the whole photosynthesis and what actually is taken in from the environment. Because some Australian wine is also quite eucalyptusy. And it seems, they can have quite a minty eucalypt kind of note. And it generally does seem to be that that is particularly prevalent in wines that are grown quite near those sort of trees. Mm. So it's quite an interesting one about how much the grapes, the leaves or whatever, seem to take from the environment. But no, smoke taints a thing. I don't think it's something anyone, would constantly try and get into their wine.
But you might as well try it if you've got smoky grapes.
It's an interesting point. If they have had a fire, that's absolutely true. You could pick that up in the
Eucalyptus trees are really interesting. They clear off a lot of pests, including mosquitoes, I recently found out. They really don't like them, which is why a lot of farmlands would plant them so that to keep away a lot of the pests.
Nice.
Bushfires, meanwhile, takes us back to a previous podcast.
Yeah, about cranberry juice. If you've got a fiery bush, bring some cranberry juice.
Yeah. There we go. Anyway, listeners, that definitely does bring us to the end. Thank you. Please do write in. We really want to know people are listening.
Yeah.
It makes us feel
so
special.
Loved.
But thank you for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. More next week with more drink chat and drinking through the airwaves. Thanks for listening. Speak to you then. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye. Drink less, drink better.
This was a Grand Cru podcast from 7 Digital.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.